cancercenter.com. You might go to the fair for the rides or funnel cakes. Our Planet Money team goes for this.
Triad Air Fan.
Ultimate Hose Nozzle.
The Vendor Marketplace.
Solar Tees. T-shirts that light up with the sun?
The Last Glue.
What does that even mean?
I mean, that's the last glue you'll ever need.
Right, right.
I'm Audie Cornish, the art of the pitch at the Ohio State Fair.
Hey, guys, come on over here. Y'all want to try it out?
This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered starts at 4 p.m. on KTOO Juno.
Tonight on 360 North at 8, Tlingit language speakers elaborate on the power and spirit of their language in building community on Forum at 360, Living the Language. American Forum, Andrew Jackson, Donald Trump, and Our Divided History looks to the past for lessons at 9. This is America and the World reviews White House drug policy at 9:30, and The Whole Truth with David Eisenhower follows at 10. Tonight on 360 North and 360north.org.
Hi, everyone. We're live and local, and we're a Juno afternoon on this Friday afternoon. I'm Andy Klein, your host for today, and we've got a full show today. Jeff's lined up for us, including we've got Red Cross and CPR training from Juno Aquatics. Julie Jackson and Nellie Connell-Haley is here, and we're also going to be talking to Nikki Skeek. She's here from Escape Alaska. Yes, very exciting escape room going to be happening. We're going to be finding out about an intensive grants workshop from Linda Bodecker, and James Hoagland will be here to talk all about the upcoming exciting drag show, Fame. That's all ahead, plus Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, fun, all that. But first, here's National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Hannah Colton, in for Antonia Gonzalez. The Yankton Sioux tribe says its constitutional rights were violated during a hearing on the Keystone XL pipeline before the Nebraska Public Service Commission Thursday. The final day of the courtroom-style testimony centered on how TransCanada and its contractors will avoid disturbing Native American cultural sites along the proposed route. Jennifer Baker is an attorney for the Yankton Sioux tribe. She says the Yankton Sioux tribe and the Ponca tribe of Nebraska were permitted just one witness each, a restriction that was not imposed on other parties during the process.
And it does really violate constitutional protections of due process and equal protection. You know, one individual doesn't have necessarily the expertise to testify about everything that each tribe is worried about with respect to this pipeline.
Baker says the tribe was only allowed to bring up cultural issues, not other concerns such as so-called man camps, one of which could be set up just 40 miles from the tribe's casino.
You have out-of-state workers from all over the country coming in, making large amounts of money, working extremely long hours under hard conditions. And along with that often comes drug and alcohol abuse, violence, and even sex trafficking. And so especially that sex trafficking is a big concern because of the proximity of the pipeline.
The tribe's request to cross-examine a TransCanada witness beyond a one-hour time limit was denied. The attorney for the Ponca tribe of Nebraska challenged a TransCanada representative on when the company became aware that the pipeline route crosses the Ponca Trail of Tears, the trail the tribe followed during their forced relocation in 1877. The Nebraska Public Service Commission is accepting written comments through Friday afternoon and will decide whether to issue a permit in late November. The panel's decision could determine whether the pipeline gets built. 10 states are joining the legal fight against a California tribe that's trying to gain more control over groundwater rights. The U.S. Supreme Court has not yet decided whether it will hear the appeal filed by the Agua Caliente Band of Cahuilla Indians. The tribe says public agencies are mismanaging their authority over the aquifer, part of which sits below the tribe's reservation. The Desert Sun reports California, Nevada, Texas, and 7 other states filed friend-of-the-court briefs opposing the tribe's position. United Tribes Technical College in North Dakota is asking for help verifying names of more than 350 Native American men who served in World War I. The college plans to honor these veterans from five North Dakota tribes during its powwow in September and with a permanent memorial on campus. UTTC has a list of North Dakota Native veterans posted online, and they're looking for assistance in gathering additional names, correct spelling and usage, details about service, and photos. The White Earth Nation in northern Minnesota is looking at hemp as a way to bring economic development to the remote reservation. Dan Gunderson reports.
Hemp has been off limits to farmers for decades because the federal government considers the cousin of marijuana a drug. But restrictions were eased a couple of years ago to allow states to set up hemp pilot projects. White Earth Tribal Secretary Treasurer Tara Mason says hemp can be used to make everything from food to construction materials.
I think we've got a whole microeconomy that can be surrounded by hemp. You know, this could really be the start of a lot of great things that we can build on in the future.
Douglas Lee is a student at the White Earth Tribal College who's helping create a hemp industry economic development plan for the Ojibwe band.
If you can integrate the hemp industry along with the building industry, mankind's always building. It's one need that is never going to run out is building material.
Before hemp can become an industry, laws must be changed to allow widespread cultivation of the crop. And there are few processing facilities in the U.S. to turn hemp into useful products. Still, the tribe has invested nearly $100,000 in this project, and White Earth Chairman Terry Tibbetts sees a future for hemp.
The only thing that we have is gamming. So, you know, we're taking a look right now at diversifying, because we don't know how long Indian gaming is going to be around.
For National Native News, I'm Dan Gunderson.
And I'm Hannah Colton.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Yate, the Albuquerque Hispano Chamber of Commerce Convention and Tourism Department welcomes the Navajo Nation Head Start School Readiness Conference, August 21st through the 24th. Information on this event and services at siabq.org. Hakuanet.
Support by BNSF Railway, proud partners of the American Indian Science and Education Society's National Conference, September 21st to 23rd, helping prepare the next generation of STEM leaders. More at bnsf.com/tribalrelations.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Brewfest is coming. K2 is proud to sponsor the Rotary Club of Juneau's 6th annual Capital Brewfest, Saturday, September 23rd from 1 to 5 at the Jack. Come enjoy great beer, live music, and fantastic food. All proceeds support the Juneau Housing First Collaborative and the humanitarian projects of Juneau Rotary. Tickets are limited and will sell out, so don't wait. Tickets available now, online only, at capbrewfest.com.
Man, welcome back to Juneau Afternoon. Andy Klein with you. Full disclosure, I have butchered a guest's name, and I'm sorry, Noe, for doing that, but it is Noe Lani Kamahaley is here with us from the Juneau Pools, and also Julie Jackson. Thanks so much to both of you for joining us here today on Juneau Afternoon. We got lots going on at the pools, and I guess the number one thing let's talk about is this Red Cross CPR training that's coming up.
Yeah, so we have a bunch of lifeguard instructors who've often taught lifeguard courses over the years, and we've had a demand and request from the community to offer first aid CPR courses. So we've actually just started doing that this past spring. We've had a few classes go off, and so we're holding them once a month. The third Saturday of each month is when we schedule them. But if groups want to reserve their private class, they can do that as well.
Cool.
We ask for a minimum of 5 to 6 people. It's 150 each person and up to 10 people per class. If you've got a bigger group, we might be able to split it or maybe add another instructor on a date of your choosing.
Yeah. So it's a key thing. Not only you guys have offered this before as it leads up to lifeguard training, but opening up to the public is a cool new thing, right?
It's pretty awesome. So we've got quite a few folks that have done it, and we're starting kids age 14 and up, so about when they start doing that babysitter class, they can come in and do this course as well, separate from it, and get them trained up, ready to go. Noe's actually one of our lead instructors and trainers for our lifeguard staff. She does an excellent job.
So when people come in to train as a lifeguard and they're doing this training, are there like common misperceptions they have about what's going to be happening, or what are the things that people are expecting, and then what actually happens in the class itself?
I think actually a common misperception is just that people don't realize, how much training really goes into being able to, effectively do these classes. And that's why offering these classes is great for the community to know how to go about this, like when an emergency happens.
Because it seems like CPR training has also evolved through the years, right? There are different things now that you're teaching that probably, right? What has changed through the years? What are some of the key things?
Well, they change everything about every, 2 years, and they add right. to the program every 5 years. And so a lot of the stuff that we're actually doing now is stuff that they used to do about 20 years ago in the courses. And so the American Heart Association, they do new research, and we get to add and teach the more effective ways to do the first aid.
Because they're collecting data all the time. Things
yeah.
happen, and they're gathering that data, what worked, what didn't work, what were things that people ran into, problems. I think that one thing in CPR, am I right that the thing about CPR, a lot of it now, is that it's not a lot so much of the pumping of the chest, it's more about the breathing? Is that correct? Or what's... what are some of the things that's happened with kind of... I'm probably wandering the territory that's completely wrong, so correct me. But how does that... is that...
So I know that the very basic public courses, they do hands-only CPR.
Okay.
And that's just to help, get everything flowing. As long as you're doing the compressions, you're helping.
I see.
You're helping
yeah.
someone, because you should never do the breast if you don't have like an appropriate barrier. So they're teaching hands only CPR so that even someone just on the side of the road can stop and help.
I see. And so I had it mixed. It's mm-hmm. the chest compressions that are the thing that can help mm-hmm. the most without harming the most, right?
Yeah.
And then beyond that, if you're very well trained, then you can do the breaths. You can do that if you have the proper guard and those kinds of things that go
yep.
into it. So and of course at the pool you have all that stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what are some of the main things that you're teaching when you're doing the CPR for lifeguard training?
So for lifeguard training, what we're mostly teaching is how to properly do the compressions, like their stances for it, and how to put in the proper breaths. Like it's a pretty straightforward, this is how we really have to do it.
To mm-hmm. make sure that, that breath goes in. And
it's effective.
If
yeah.
you've ever taken a Red Cross course or a CPR course over the years, the compression ratios, I think, is probably what's changed the most from course to course to course.
Yeah.
And so what I've really appreciated over the last few years is they've actually simplified it. So it's similar compressions ratios to breaths. So it's getting just a little more streamlined, a little bit more easy, so you aren't panicking.
Right.
In a moment where you shouldn't panic.
Now, has it come up? Has it come up at the Juno pools? Has CPR needed to be administered, and what's happened in those situations?
Yeah, actually, we had an incident at the Diamond Park facility about a year and a half ago, I think it was, and Noe was one of the first responders on site, and her and another one of our staff members performed CPR and started to administer oxygen until EMTs arrived, and it was, I'm getting kind of chills thinking
yeah,
about it right now.
Sure. I mean, I was going to say, it's a traumatic thing to talk about, even for people who
yeah.
are trained or first responders. You can't just talk about it like it was a clinical exercise, right? I mean, people's lives were at stake, and it's a traumatic thing.
Yeah, and I believe it was Rich Etheridge with the CCFR asked to recognize Noe as well as our other guard, Maddie, in front of the assembly for the hard work, and they were incredibly complimentary. So I was extremely
That's
proud
great.
As an aquatics manager,
yeah.
and it was a pretty intense situation, but they helped prolong the life of the individual to get him to the hospital and on to further care.
Further care.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. I mean, and that's what this whole thing's designed to mm-hmm. do, right? What are some of the other things that people need to know if they're going to train to be a lifeguard? Like, what makes a good lifeguard?
Good fitness. So you don't need to be an Olympic swimmer by any means. You don't even have to be on the high school swim team. But if you enjoy swimming, you can swim well, and you have a level head, and you're interested, come on by. We have swim tests. We actually have a lifeguard course coming up after.
Whistleblowing.
Yep.
The
key
skill.
Something you practice.
We'll teach you that.
Yeah, we'll teach that. The confidence to blow a whistle very loudly. And
it's part of our training.
Right.
So, yeah, it's just the confidence to come in and do it. We can help teach that as well. And we've got courses going on throughout the year. Our next one, like I said, is after Labor Day. The swim test, the pre-course we call it, is actually on the 2nd of September, so Saturday the 2nd in the morning. You can come in and do that. But if you aren't able to make it because you're going out of town for a long weekend, give us a call anytime at Diamond Park Pool, and we can get somebody to do the pre-course test with you. So
Something that when we use the pool, we always just have this assumption like, well, they'll have lifeguards and it'll be fine. But there's a real recruitment. There's really
Absolutely.
A thing that you have to do to get those people there, get competent people who stay, that sort of thing, right?
Especially in Juneau, when we have to train our hiring pool. And just by passing a class doesn't actually make you the perfect candidate to become a lifeguard on staff.
Right.
So we hold as many courses as we can throughout the year to facilitate having a larger pool of employees. But we are hiring right now, so if anybody is a certified lifeguard, especially those UAS students come into town, we are recruiting and taking applications for lifeguards. We always lose kids. I call them kids, but they're adults going to college this time of year, as well as the students going back to high school. So we're always looking for more lifeguards, especially in August and September.
But it's great training, too, and there's such responsibility that goes along with it. It can be a fun job, but it's also got a lot of responsibility and a lot of a lot of great experience that goes along with it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So anything else happening in the pool we should know about? There's some membership stuff happening, right?
Yeah. We've got a couple different programs going on. So our annual memberships, we're going to be offering monthly deductions from your credit card. So you can sign up for an annual pass. You commit to that annual pass, but then you'll have your monthly fee deducted from your card. So it'll be a little bit more than just paying a monthly pass, or sorry, an annual membership total for that service fee each month. The convenience of not having to think about it.
That's kind of nice because if you know you're going to be gone in October or something like that, then you can, that's a good way to do it.
Yeah, probably, so you can start out paying for the year. We also have a bulk ticketing program, which is pretty awesome. You can buy a book of 25 tickets for $150, so about $6 a ticket there, and that gets you entry into either pool or even Treadwell Arena, which just opened up this past week.
Yeah, and I mean, both pools are such great resources. The Valley Pool is so fun and all that great stuff for kids. And then the Augustus Brown Pool, it's like, it's a pool.
Absolutely.
Man, right? I mean, that to me is like, that's a pool.
That's where
I love Augustus Brown Pool.
The biggest decisions in Juneau are made,
that's
I think,
right.
In that sauna.
Oh, that sauna. Well, yeah. You have to have clearance before you get into the sauna, right?
I don't know about that. I think they'll welcome pretty much anybody.
That's
They're pretty
true.
Welcoming.
It's an open discussion. That's right. And anything on schedules you should know? I guess school year starting, so swim team, stuff like that?
Yeah, absolutely. So we've had some schedule changes. It happens every year for this time of year. We have to remember, 3 months, that's all it is, where there's two high school teams practicing at JD down at Augustus Brown, and then TM at the Valley. So a little bit of lane reduction here and there, but we're actually opening up some lane usage to the public in the morning time while the school district is at Augustus Brown. Typically, we've always been closed 8 to 11, Monday through Friday, but starting next week with school starting, we're actually going to keep the pool open a little bit where we have some lanes for the school district because they don't use the entire facility,
right.
But we'll have the sauna, the fitness equipment, and then the small pool open when it's not being utilized by their classes.
Well, great. It's Juneau Aquatics, and Noe and Julie, thanks so much for coming in, telling us all about it. And if you want to find out more about that, JunoPools.org is the place to go to find out more about the training, about becoming a lifeguard, about the schedules and all that stuff that's happening with the pools in Juneau.
Awesome.
Thanks, Julie. Thanks, Noe.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
It. All right.
The economy in Alaska is changing. Join the conversation on how to navigate the new terrain at the Southeast Conference annual meeting September 19th through 21st in Haines. With more than 40 speakers and attendees that range from policymakers and elected officials to community members and business leaders, the Southeast Conference annual meeting will address key issues facing our region. Find out more at seconference.org. Early registration rates expire August 15th. Southeast Conference annual meeting, navigating the Southeast economy.
50 years ago this summer was a time of flowers in our hair and fire in our bellies, marked by war and injustice, but also peace and love. KRNN is celebrating this pivotal time in American history with a week of music from the summer of love. We're dusting off the vinyl and making playlists. Listen all week for rock, pop, folk, jazz, blues, and more on KRNN 102.7.
Love him so much, old Rupert Holmes here. And, yes, Pina Colada song, but it's also the escape song, Plan Our Escape. And that's what you can do at an escape room, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Nikki Skeek is here with us, who, is it Escape AK?
It's Escape Game Alaska.
Escape Game Alaska.
Yep.
All right, so we got to get that going.
My sign just went up, too.
Okay, very cool. Now,
yeah.
So this is a new, fun, cool activity to do. It's mm-hmm. something that's kind of sweeping the world,
oh,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
This idea
yeah.
of escape rooms.
Oh, yeah.
And it's going to be located kind of below Salt, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that kind of the idea? That's
yeah.
kind of the general area where it is. So tell me, first of all, what is this global phenomena happening with escape rooms? What's it all about? How does it work?
So there's this new industry, and it's called the experience industry, and basically everything from like zip lining to going out on whale tours and stuff like that, and then escape rooms are all part of the experience industry. For a long time, people would go out and they'd tour and they'd just be like, I'm going to buy a t-shirt, I'm going to buy a picture, I'm going to buy something, and I'm going to take it home. There's my trip.
Right.
But now a big thing is you'd rather buy an experience. You have a memory that you take with you that you can't ever get rid of.
Sure,
right?
Yeah.
Barring concussions. No, I'm just kidding.
right. Well, that's, yeah.
So basically what happened is in like 2008, this guy in Kyoto, Japan, invented them. And he created not only, I think, the interactive live experience, but he created an online gaming platform for escape rooms. And basically you download it and you go through a room and you figure out where all the hidden clues are, you figure out puzzles, you decode encrypted messages, and then you undo combos and locks in order to escape a room or complete the mission. And I always tell people it's kind of like Goonies or Indiana Jones or something. And the first thing people think is like, it's just like Saw. But it's not like Saw. It's nothing like Saw. You'll be fine, I promise.
Not that horrible. Yeah, right.
It's really fun. And so they've been introduced to the experience industry because so many people love getting together and doing those types of things and completing
sure.
a mission and, you know, being
and
a hero.
And it feeds so much into that, you know, the player phenomena, video games and all
exactly.
those things. It's all about teams, clues,
mm-hmm.
trying things, finding stuff where you wouldn't expect to find stuff, and then
exactly.
that leads you to the next mission kind of thing.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
So, like, I was a super Zelda fan. That
yeah.
game was, like, my
sure.
favorite, and you go exploring everywhere and finding clues and stuff. So, like, one of my rooms is the espionage room, which is the one that was in the paper, you know, the full spread picture
right.
gives you an idea of what it looks like. And it's kind of like the office of Dr. Evil. So you get one clue when you start the mission, and you have to start digging through stuff and figuring out, okay, well, these are the keys, and these are the combos, and this is what I have to do. And it really keys into, like you said, team building.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, in Seattle, where the
the industry was first introduced to, like, the U.S., they have seriously boomed. So, like, Amazon and Google will actually use them as corporate team-building exercises, and they have a bunch of people who will come, and actually they'll do pop-up escape rooms. So a company will be hired to go to, like, Amazon and Google, and they'll design something for, like, lead coders that require them to go and figure out how to escape or complete a mission. But for, like, friends and family, it's really cool because you start a room and you have to lock your cell phone away, and you're forced to interact with the people that you're in the room
you're
with.
You're in the moment.
Exactly.
Yeah, you're completely immersed in that moment.
Exactly.
And in this one mission that you have to do. So what if you go to the Escape Game Alaska and you're – so is it a thing where, like, you are – is it totally dark? Are you put in a room and you, like, you don't know where you are? Are you disoriented on purpose? I mean, what –
so
that
I can't
stuff?
Tell you everything.
Well, I know. Okay,
yeah,
right.
Everything's a surprise.
Right,
but
right.
The biggest thing about it is a lot of escape rooms, like, some of them are sensory experiences and some of them – are just basic experiences. So I have three different levels of these types of rooms. I didn't want it to be, like, so hard that people couldn't complete it, and then I didn't want it to be so easy that people get bored.
Right.
So I have three different experiences. I have Rowdy's Gold Claim, which is a Gold Rush-style cabin. And then I have the Insanity Room, which is a two-person experience. So if you really want to see if the person you're dating is fun or not, good luck. And then the other one is the Espionage Room, which is, like, a pretty... like, basic room. And for anybody who's got, you know, some people have been like, oh, I'm too anxious to do this, or I don't want to be scared, or I don't like that, you know, enclosed feeling. They're super safe. You're not locked in the room. The espionage room, it's basically like sitting in a director's office. So, you know, it's all dependent on what you want to do. Some sensory experiences, like, you know, I did one in Belgrade, Montana, which is outside of Bozeman, and when I did that one, I was literally climbing through laser beams, and there was this really cool thing where if you triggered a laser beam or if you messed up in the game, this really loud alarm would go off, and it was like, and it was completely jarring, and it would speed up the clock. So you regularly have an hour, but if you didn't back out of that mistake, then the clock would continue going faster and faster, and then that alarm would go off the whole time. So, like, there's stuff like that. If you really like the hard ones, which I do, I'm, like, addicted.
Yeah.
I'm an escape room enthusiast now, so everywhere I go, I'm like, you guys have to come and do this. it depends on what you want.
Yeah.
Some of them have darkness. Some of them you're climbing through tunnels. Some of them have laser beams and smoke and all of that.
Wow, Is it appropriate for just one or two people and also large groups, or how do you see people doing it?
So this is the cool thing. I was just telling Jeff Brown this. So, like, say you want to meet some people, right? When you look on the booking form, when I have the website done, you'll see that, like, some rooms fit 8 people. So my Gold Rush room should fit 8 people, and then the Insanity room will fit 2, and then the Espionage room will be 6 to 8, depending on what the city says. So once I have that, if you look on the booking form, say a room has 2 seats available, and you want to meet some people. You're bored. Sign up for a room that, you know, has a seat available for you and go meet some people. It's kind of cool because you're, like, submerged in interacting with people that you don't even know, but it forces you to interact because I think a lot of people get nervous when you're in an environment like, say you go bowling and you're meeting new people. You have people who are on the phone. You have people who are, you know, going and ordering food or getting stuff or getting
shoes.
And
you're being competitive at a sport
exactly.
And you feel weird. But this is just like you're all working together to solve a common problem.
Exactly. And you'll be surprised, too, because, like, you'll go on a team, right, and you'll have, like, say 6 people. And you'll think, oh, this person's like a born leader. They're the one that's like the alpha, you know. And then you watch them and they don't excel in that. And then you'll see them really good at something else. And then somebody who you wouldn't think is a good leader totally excels. So there have been people who have done, like, corporate team building exercises who have gotten promotions out of doing exercises and, like, showing that they're, like, dominant at certain skills.
So what are you – yeah, so is that leads me to that question. Like, what do you think – as a business owner, what do you think your audiences are going to be? Corporate team building might be one of them, maybe. Or is it – do you think it's just sort of – to start with, it's just going to be kind of a social fun thing and for people who are into it? Or,
it's everything. I have escape room enthusiasts that I've seen at, like, garage sales who are like, oh, my God, I'm your first customer, you know, and they're just, like, out for fun. But they go on family trips, and, like, they make sure that that's something that their family does, you know. So it's family. And then friends, bachelorette parties, friends who go out and they just do social group events and stuff like that, and then the corporate team building. So I have friends at JEDC, and they're like, you have to get me in. And then I've had friends who have businesses who are like, I want to bring all my staff in. So across the board, it's kind of one of those things where, like, it, you know, it hits everybody's interest because it's this new thing that people hear about, and they're like, oh, I have to try it, you know? So you're
a small business owner now.
Mm-hmm.
You're starting this business.
Yeah.
What have been some of the hurdles? You're starting a business that's never been done, that's probably even hard to explain, like, to permitters. How has that all worked, right? I'm building a room that's impossible to escape from. You know what I mean? Like, well, we're not going to let you do that.
Right? Yeah. Even getting insurance for, like, this business is interesting.
So what are some of,
like,
the hurdles that you've hit on there?
Everything.
And then plus you're transforming what is essentially a basement into these rooms that need to be recognized, almost like movie sets, right? Supposed to be recognizable.
There's
rooms.
Themed adventure sets.
Everything.
So I've literally been doing everything from, like, framing walls to, like, hanging sheetrock and, like, doing drywall and mud and paint and tape and everything. I think the biggest hurdle is living in Juneau and dealing with contractors who have sunshine fever.
It's been tough the last couple of weeks, right?
Oh, my God, dude. I'll be there at noon. You don't see them for, like, a week. So that's a massive hurdle.
Hard to blame them.
Yeah. I get it. I totally get it. But, like, I'm pulling out all the favors right now and friends who can come and possibly help me. So that's been a big hurdle. The other hurdle is, like, I'm a very detailed person. So having gone to ones in Seattle and Anchorage and Montana and Texas, like, having seen these, I really want mine to be good. So, like, the thing that's really hard is that I've been to one in Austin, Texas, which I think when it was built was, like, a $1 million facility. Like, these games aren't cheap to, like, start and purchase and do. So the one in Austin, trying to even stay on par with some businesses that are at that level, that's a major hurdle. Because I don't want to deliver something that's subpar, substandard. And I really want, like, people to hear to have something really cool, you know? And we're in one of the biggest, like, tour destinations in the world. We just had Oprah. Like,
hey, I know. Oprah.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, Salt just had Carlos Boozer there the other night. So, like, I really want something that, like, people who come in who are, you know, at that level would even be like, whoa, this is really cool, you know? Even if it is just
Juneau. Or just people who've done these games before.
Yeah.
They come to Juneau or they're from Juneau or whatever. Well, you want it to be comparable. Yeah.
Exactly.
Right.
So that's the thing.
Yeah, with that in mind, what's the idea on, number one, when do you think you'll be open? And then also pricing and how people can start signing up or get more information, that sort of thing.
So I have my business phone. They can contact that. If you want that number, I'll give it to you. I have my website, which should be done in a couple of days. I've just been kind of backtracked dealing with contractor stuff. But I have my website. I have my Facebook page. They can contact me via there. I'm hoping that maybe in 3 weeks at latest I would be open. It's dealing with this city and ensuring that everything's safe and everything's good. And also, like, making sure that, like, I'm not working while people are in there. All that stuff probably takes me back to, I think, 3 weeks might be my open date.
And you see it as being something that's going to be year-round, open to locals, but also kind of next summer, kind of accommodating for the rush of tourists as well?
Yeah. I'm hoping, like, because the tourists have, you know, they have their summer bookings and stuff, next summer I'm hoping that I can probably open at, like, 10 a.m. because I'm watching, you know, other cities and stuff and their activity, and, like, I know the locations of the other ones and their, you know, traffic and stuff, and I'm in a really good location, like, being underneath Salt, like, right in the high traffic area. I think they're starting to call it the Deco District. I don't know, because they have all the new bars and the distilleries and the restaurants in there. So being right in the heart of that, like, it's the perfect location, and I know I can get traffic from a lot of the tourists, but I'm hoping to make sure that locals really get the time to do it. And what's really cool is, like, a lot of the students, like, I have friends from all the little villages and stuff, they're like, my kids have to come and do this, you know, and that's, like, from Whitehorse to, you know, like, Ketchikan to Yakutat to, like, all over. So, like, I know I have to stay open and cater to that. But people can do private bookings, too. So if people want to do a private party and whatnot, then I can open because I'll have a private entrance. We just pushed the door back between Silverbow and Salt. So there's just horrible looking cavity in the wall there right now. But I'm hoping to get that taken care of, and the sign will be up showing, you know, where
cool.
it is.
Well, it's all going to be happening within the next month or so,
yes.
right? And it's Escape Game Alaska.
Yep.
And so kind of maybe Google that in the next few weeks or something,
yeah.
and you'll start coming up with the hits on the website once it's live.
Yeah.
And sounds like a lot of fun. Nikki, congratulations on getting it going.
Thank you.
And it freaks me out a little bit, but I think I'm going
to
do it.
Oh, you have to do it. I might make you do it.
Yeah, right. Okay, this is the commitment. It's going to happen. All right.
Exactly.
All right, thanks so much. Hey, coming up next is Writer's Almanac. Here's Garrison Keillor.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday, the 11th of August, 2017. It's the birthday of the short story writer André Debus, born Lake Charles, Louisiana, 1936, who said, "We don't have to live great lives. We just have to understand and survive the ones we've got." It's the birthday of Alex Haling, Ithaca, New York, 1921, grew up in Tennessee, sat listening to his mother's family tell stories about their forebears, many of whom were slaves. He went on to be a freelance writer. He did an interview with Malcolm X for Playboy magazine, which then turned into the book The Autobiography of Malcolm X, came out in 1965. And then Alex Haley began researching his own genealogy, tracing his family back to Gambia, where he went to interview tribal leaders, spent more than 10 years working on that book, writing on yellow legal tablets. Book came out in 1976, Roots, The Saga of an American Family. It was a mixture of fact and fiction, tracing generations of his family from an 18th century slave named Kunta Kinte down to the author himself. It was adapted into a 12-hour television miniseries, and more than 130 million people tuned in to watch it when it was shown on television. It's the birthday of the poet and critic Louise Bogan, born in Livermore Falls, Maine, 1897. W.H. Auden considered her the greatest critic of poetry of the time. He gave the eulogy at her funeral. She went off to New York City. She fell in with William Carlos Williams and Edmund Wilson, started writing reviews, which could be tough on famous poets. Marianne Moore, Wallace Stevens, she said, "They will never surprise anyone again. They are half dead already." She became poetry editor of the New Yorker magazine, and she had a big raucous affair with a younger poet, Theodore Rethke. She wrote to a friend, "I myself have been made to bloom like a Persian rose bush by the enormous lovemaking of Theodore Rethke, who is very, very large, 6 feet two, 218 pounds, and he writes very, very small lyrics. We have poured rivers of liquor down our throats these last 3 days, and in between have indulged in such bearish antics as I have never before experienced. I hope that one or two immortal lyrics will come out of all this tumbling about." They remained close friends after their romance was over. Here's a poem for today by Jane Adonucci entitled Falling. "I've fallen many times, the usual stumbles over secret schoolgirl crushes, head over heels for teen heartthrobs, I love them all. I've fallen so many times, tripped down the aisle over husband, daughter, son, madly and deeply, I love them all. I've fallen again and again, new friends, a mentor, a muse, numerous books, a few authors, 4 dear pups, and a stranger or two, I loved them all. I've fallen farther, fallen faster, now captivated, I tumble, enthralled with my grandchildren, I love them, each, forever and all. Falling, a poem by Jane Atenucci from her collection First Mud, published by Finishing Line Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetrymagazine.org. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Just got a little more fabulous in the studio here as James Hoagland just walked in. How you doing?
Hello, good.
Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, Andy.
And we're going to talk about Fame, the drag show happening tomorrow
Fame.
Night.
Fame, I'm going to live
forever. I love this. I'm bringing this up on YouTube, too, and it's actually the opening credits to Fame, the TV show, or...
Oh, yeah, it was a TV show, too.
It was
too.
A TV show,
yeah.
too. I think it's the TV
show.
Yeah.
Movie musical.
Yes. Oh, my
incredible.
Goodness.
Billy the memories.
Hupsy. All right, whatever. I don't know those people. They did not achieve Fame, as it turned out. Ironically,
yeah, well.
Many of the people in Fame did not actually live forever. But tell me about the drag show. It's a fun theme. I mean, it's a...
Yeah, so, you know, there's been this long connection to loving Broadway and musicals and stuff for the LGBT community. And so there's no... no reason why we wouldn't do a movie musical theme.
Right. No,
so,
absolutely.
Yeah, so we have all picked our favorite musicals, whether it's a Broadway show or a remake, you know, everything from Rent to Hedwig to Hairspray, you know, and then some of our favorite movies and the soundtracks to those, like some Disney movies are in there, some classic 80s and 90s big movie hits.
Yeah.
And then some TV shows. And we put together a drag show with all of those favorite characters and theme songs.
It seems like for drag culture, it seems like that era, right, of the 70s, 80s just seems to fit really well, right? Like
it
that.
Does.
Why is
can
that? Can you put that into words? It's an interesting. I think of like Gloria Gaynor and
you know
like
it was
these...
like the era of the diva.
Yeah,
right.
Right
there was
yeah,
like the
sure.
disco diva. So that emerged as like an American icon, and I think you know naturally a lot of drag queens related to that and
it's
kind
fun,
of took
it's
it from
big,
there.
It's fun. It's big. It's showy.
Right.
Sparkles. There's like
big
you,
hair.
You can't go
sequins,
too big, right? Like you
dance music.
Yeah. There's no such thing as too big.
Peas in a pot.
Right, exactly. The
exactly.
bigger the hair, the better.
You know,
that.
By the time
yeah.
we got to the 90s, everything started scaling back, and it got boring again. So
right.
we always take it back a little bit.
Right. Yeah, I can't even imagine a 90s icon that you would want to... Maybe it's kind of come back around. Lady Gaga and stuff like that has kind of got back up to this kind of Beyonce and those
Gaga.
Things, right? Lady Gaga and Beyonce and all that
right.
stuff.
Right.
Kind of volumizing
totally.
the chic that's behind the... kind of the female kind of expressive form, and that's
exactly.
such a fun thing to play into with the drag
oh, exactly.
culture, right?
I mean, you can really camp those things up and just, you know, whether you perform it straightforward, like you're that character, or you kind of take a new twist on it and make it extra campy or funny or weird. I mean, we have all of that in our performers here in Juneau. They're so creative.
Yeah.
So they take things in really interesting directions. And, you know, sometimes I'm not even sure what they're going to do
well,
when
the
they
Juneau
get on stage.
Lens, right? The lens of Juneau,
right.
the weird.
That little fisheye kind of. but that's what makes it so exciting and
you
fun.
Were saying it's all locals this time.
It
right?
is. It is all local performers. We've got 11 performers, including myself, tomorrow night. And we have two brand new
And I wanted
performers.
To talk about that. Now, that's a fun thing to think about. So if someone was ever interested or thought, wow, I might be interested in doing that. So how do you bring along a newbie?
Yeah,
right?
You know, it's funny. They come out of the woodworks. And I tell you what, every show we've done... I've had at least one, sometimes two or three brand new people in every single show. And it is so cool because, you know, maybe they've come to the shows and they are really inspired or they think it looks fun or they think they could do it.
And then, you know, sometimes they'll sheepishly come up to me and be like, do you think maybe I could do a number sometime? And it's like, okay, baby, like what, you know, what's going on here? And come to find out, they've got the routine, the choreography, the outfit.
Is that typically it?
Yes, exactly. They come
typically
ready.
Already have it. This is it. This is
by
the
time they come and ask me about performing,
they've been thinking about it.
It's
right.
Like they are ready to burst. Like they have to do this number. It is like a jack in the box. That's and you're like, oh, okay. Awesome. Welcome to the family. You're on. Like, this is great.
That's
so
cool.
Yeah. So are that's kind of like these two who came up this time. They've actually performed before in other places down south and kind of been laying low in Juneau for a few years.
Right.
And they finally got the courage up to join the show here. So.
Are there sort of cliched first acts that people do? Are there ones that like, oh, okay, that's going to be a Maryland type, or that's going to be this,
yeah,
or something like
you
that?
You know, it's
or
funny you mentioned the 70s and 80s era, and I think those are kind of the quintessential drag numbers, you know, the Gloria Gaynors, the
Cher,
I Will Survive,
the, yeah, right,
or,
right.
Or Cher,
yeah,
right, exactly.
Right.
You know, those are the crowd favorites. Those are usually pretty high energy numbers. They feel good. It's about just being larger than life. So it's a natural fit, and it's the easiest to sell to
mm-hmm.
an audience.
Yeah.
If someone came to me and they wanted to do a 6-minute ballad as their first number,
that would be, yeah.
I might encourage them to rethink that. You know, a ballad, even though you might think, well, you're not dancing or you know, there's not a lot of complicated choreography or something like that. It's really, really hard to sell a ballad.
Well, you have to have a lot of charisma.
Oh,
you
yeah.
have to really have a lot of presence.
Right.
Just as a balladeer
right.
in any form,
right?
To
right.
pull off a ballad.
Exactly.
You don't have any help. You know, you don't
no.
have a beat. You don't have any of that. It's just you.
Right.
So
the confidence has
right.
to be like through the roof.
Right.
Like you've got to really know what you're doing.
Right.
And,
right.
And, you know, I don't even do ballads. Like, I don't encourage anyone to really do ballads.
Right.
But every now and then, you know, there's someone who can really dial in and sell it. But it takes a while. So
yeah.
I usually steer the newbies away from those.
Yes, that's
more
interesting.
More complicated.
Right, yeah.
Yeah,
that's,
yeah.
Well, that's fun to think about. So, all right, it's happening tomorrow night.
Tomorrow night at Rendezvous, our favorite local dive drag bar. We have totally taken over that bar, and I love them for it.
Yes.
It's just like the perfect place for
They'll
a drag
never
show.
Get the glitter out of the floorboards
no.
at this point. No,
and they don't need to.
No, it's in there.
I mean, it's perfect, yeah. So
well,
we got
cool.
two shows. 8 o'clock and 10 o'clock, and now they're two different shows. So you could come for the 8 o'clock show and stay the whole night, but if you have to skip out, you can leave at intermission. That's fine. If you can't show up till later, if you're working late or something, come on in about 9:30, 9:45, and you'll be there for the 10 o'clock show.
Great.
So we like to give people options because it can get kind of crowded in there.
It
and,
definitely can get. I mean, it's packed out. Yeah,
it
I mean,
is
yeah,
a packed
it's
a,
it's,
house.
It's the
yep.
place to be when
it
these things
the
happen. Yeah, right, man.
Who
and,
knew?
Yeah, well, hey, you
Juneau.
Know. And what's the admission? Or
it's $8
okay.
at the door.
Great.
Yep.
Oh man,
and
bargain.
It's,
yeah,
it's a bargain deal. We've got lots of ones for sale, so you don't have to go to the ATM before.
Oh, there you go. All right, very good.
We can swipe your card, give you some ones, and you'll be on your way.
All right.
Ready to tip the queens.
There you go. Very good. All right. Well, it's Fame. It's happening tomorrow night, 8 o'clock. And James Hoagland, thanks so much for bringing all this stuff to our town and
yeah.
kind of perpetuating it, keeping it going. And thanks for coming in and letting us know about it today.
Thanks, Andy.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.
The burrowing owl's vocal abilities have raised eyebrows among birders and scientists alike. Because as well as its double hoots and other calls, the burrowing owl is known for this hair-raising sound. Standing on almost comically long legs, this yellow-eyed owl is very active in daytime, and its hissing habit may have evolved to mimic the sibilant warning given by a cornered rattlesnake. This sonic threat of a venomous reptile could be just enough to warn away most unwanted visitors from the owl's nest burrow. In one experiment, ground squirrels were nearly as alarmed by the burrowing owl's hiss as they were by the recording of a real rattlesnake like this one. Despite its name, the burrowing owl doesn't do much digging, though. Instead, it's more of a squatter, nesting and roosting in vacant rodent burrows, often those of prairie dogs, until it's time to eat. Not content with providing the burrowing owl's accommodation, rodents, especially mice, also provide lunch. Well, they are lunch, with a side of large insects. Before the burrowing owl retires again to its mostly subterranean life.
And that's Bird Note. Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. Andy Klein with you. And Linda Bodecker's here to talk about an intensive grants workshop that's happening. Linda, thanks so much for joining us on the line.
Oh, you are so welcome. Thank you.
So tell me about this. The information I know is that we have an intensive grants workshop coming up. So,
there's a bit more to it than that.
I've been hearing on K2 here, we've been playing some public service announcements about what's going on, and sounds like an opportunity for people that are involved in nonprofits that have ever either wondered about or wanted to get better at writing grants. It's a workshop that really allows people to kind of take that next step.
You are correct. This is from an organization called the Grantsmanship Center, and they are based in California, and they've been in existence for well over 40 years, and they are the leaders in this field. And essentially, the week is, we kind of call it a boot camp for grant proposal writers. So we start Monday morning. We spend all week. A lot of it's doing, we don't like to sit down and start writing. There's a lot of preparation and planning so that the people who are attending can figure out what their organizations need to accomplish, who their work will benefit, and how much money they're going to need. So it's a wonderful week and a wonderful process, and we're very thankful to the Art Center for bringing us in and exposing us to all these wonderful organizations in Juneau.
So what are some of the roadblocks that are commonly in, you find that people feel are in their way to getting to the grants that they need?
I think that it is forgetting that it is what we do is nonprofits, and we have nonprofits, we have government agencies, sometimes we have faith-based organizations. And so remembering that what we're doing is benefiting those that we serve. And so focusing on that makes for a much stronger proposal, but it also just sort of keeps us in line with the work that we do. And those that we serve sometimes are people, and sometimes they're animals, and sometimes it's the environment. It doesn't matter, but if we're focusing on them instead of getting money for our organization, say, to keep the lights on, then we just have a stronger argument to those funders.
I see, yeah. So tell me a little bit about what people will go through here. Is this a course that can be for people who've maybe never written a grant before, or is it tailored?
Absolutely. I have people who attend who are just starting, don't know what a request for proposal looks like, have never been exposed to it, and then I have people who've been doing it for 30 years and they need a refresher. So, and the beauty of being with a group like this for the whole week is they definitely help each other out quite a bit. And again, they don't just sit down and start riding. It's a lot of the planning process and figuring out what they need. And then when we go through that process and they kind of figure out what they need and how much they need, we also spend time looking at potential funders, who's a good match. Then the students also, by the end of the week, get to spend time reviewing each other's proposals. So we get to turn the tables a little bit, and they get to be the grant reviewers as well, which is a great part of the learning process.
Has the world of grant writing and getting grants changed pretty dynamically over the past number of years? I just imagine that maybe it has, or the access to grants through the use of the Internet.
Right, it has. So the application process has changed quite a bit in that you're right. A lot of it is done online. I'd say just like in any aspect of fundraising, sometimes the money is a bit tighter, so we need to be even better and stronger in what we do. So those are probably the two biggest. There used to be a bigger sort of pool of what we always call just general operating funds, that you're a good organization doing good work, and there'll be somebody to say, here's money to help you do that. But now we really focus on the programs and the projects and the work the organization's doing and who it's benefiting.
Yeah, so it's really just become much more specific, and you have people who are looking to grant to mission-oriented organizations. Is that kind of correct?
Absolutely.
Yeah, right.
Absolutely, yeah. Very well put. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
You mentioned times have gotten tighter. Are there things that people need to keep in mind as they think about, grants as we've kind of, as finances have kind of changed over the past few years?
I think the biggest thing is that in any and all aspects of fundraising, that we don't want to ever be dependent on any one source of money. So even though we're going to be there teaching about grant proposal writing all week, we want to make sure that those folks coming from the nonprofit world are doing everything else they can do to have a well-rounded and diversified fundraising plan, which means people and corporations and in-kind gifts and everything, that they can't be dependent on anyone.
The old diversified portfolio. Yeah, we've heard that
you
term
got it.
Personal
right.
Finances before. I'm sure it applies there as
right.
Well. Well,
if we'd only listened to that many years ago, we'd probably be
I know. Oh, I hate those words. so tell me about how people can get involved in this and how they can sign up or
sure.
who might
and
think
we
about
do
doing
so-
it. Yeah.
You bet. We still have a few seats available, and the website is www.tgci.com, and that's for the Grantsmanship Center. And
can you say those four letters again?
Uh-huh.
Is it PGCI?
T as in Tom.
T as in Tom. TGCI.
Uh-huh.
Great.
Uh-huh. G as in Grant. C as in Complex. TGCI.com.
Okay.
And they would need to just go online and register probably this weekend because we won't be able to handle a last-minute registration on Monday morning. But if they can register this weekend, we have some extra books and things. And it starts at 8:30 on Monday morning at the Juno Arts Facility.
And runs through Friday?
It runs through about 1 o'clock on Friday.
Wow. Okay. So this really is a boot camp. This is you're going to be learning about grants all week.
Right. That word intensive was a good one.
Tell me about how that process works, where people get to review each other's grants at the end of this this week.
So they work together during the week. We kind of team up and those with interest in each other's organizations. They work in teams to actually write a proposal. So they walk away from this class with a proposal in hand. So we have several groups that then turn in their proposals, and then we as a group or as several groups have the opportunity to sort of go through each of the proposals sort of with a fine-tooth comb to say, to let them know how we think it could be stronger. So the ones that have written them are learning from those reviewing. And, of course, anytime we review a proposal, we pick up great ideas as well. So it's my favorite part of the week. I think it's really, as the instructor, of course, I get to hear about everything they've learned and put to use, but it's a really fun process.
Well, it's the Intensive Grants Workshop. It's happening all next week. A few spots are still available, but get them now if you want them. That's at tgci.com. And Linda Bodecker, thanks so much for telling us all about it, and have a great week next week.
Thank you, Andy. You
okay.
too.
All right.
Bye-bye.
And that's it for a Juno afternoon for this Friday. Thanks so much to all my guests for joining me, and have a great weekend, everyone.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and